On the field, winning comes from hard work, care, and preparation. I learned that that same hard work doesn't stop when we exit the arena. Your care is our commitment, and preparation is our promise. We tackle challenges head on and turn dreams into reality, which is why I'm excited to join the team at Alcova Mortgage, where we help you score the perfect home.
And welcome into the Who's On podcast, part of the Saber Podcast Network, presented in part by Joe Reed and Alcova Mortgage. Score your perfect home. Today, it is Masters Week. I've got the Masters polo on for my former neighbors at Augusta National, but it's also peak transfer portal season and basketball and everything going on, swirling around there. And so we got Chris Wright from thesaber.com on to talk some hoops right now and some transfer portal talk. But coming up later, you know, spring football also coming around to the end. We got the spring game coming up on Saturday. So I've got Eric Ward, Assistant Athletics Director for Marketing, coming on to talk about some of the stuff that they got going on for the spring game, but also talking about how do you get more butts in the seats in Scott Stadium? So that's going to be, it was a really interesting conversation. That's coming up later. For now, Chris, how's it going, man?
It's good. Obviously, transfer portal mania going on. So
it feels like you can't really, you know, catch a break, and, you know, every couple hours something new is coming up, and that's just the way it is right now, especially when you're trying to remake an entire roster in one off season, which is something new for I think all of us covering UVA athletics.
Now, when you're adding 10 or more players, there's going to be a lot of news. That's a lot of spots. So, you know, there's obviously a lot happening there. Curious to kind of see what kind of pans out with the last handful of spots here, but I don't think we're one or two spots left. I think there's still three, four, maybe five spots left. Yeah. You know, when you look at how the roster is currently being built,
I think we're only halfway there in complete honesty. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, make jokes about, you know, UVA is more guards than Shawshank right now, or more guards than the Queen or King, but that's kind of where we are. So let's get into it. Five transfers in 5 days has a nice ring to it. Obviously, coming into this time last week, they didn't have anyone. They had two freshmen coming in, Chance Mallory and Silas Barksdale. We've talked about them before. And they have Elijah Gertrude, who is still on the roster. So, you know, again, another point for, you know, Gertrude sticking to his word from what he told me in the story, you know, a month ago. But picking up five transfers in 5 days. We'll start in kind of chronological order here. So last, I think it was Saturday, Sam Lewis from Toledo, the Toledo wing, averaged 16 points a game, a little over four rebounds, and shoots 44% from three, 6'6", so can play either the two or the three spot. Then he had North Dakota State guard Jakari White, averaged 17 points a game, four rebounds, two assists, and shot nearly 40% on seven and three attempts per game, with so really high volume there. Then Duke Miles from Oklahoma, averaged 9 points a game, two assists, and shot 43% from three. Before that, he was at Troy and then High Point before going to Oklahoma. At High Point 2 years ago, he averaged 17 points a game. And then from there, we got our first VCU guy, and I'm going to go with Martin Carrere. I don't have any French pronunciation guides in my past. He redshirted last year, so he still has 4 years of eligibility left. His bio on VCU's website describes him as an elite shooter and high-level passer. That just sounds like any European player, I guess you could say. And then last night, the latest one is Dalen Hall, the point guard from BYU. Averaged just a tick under 7 points a game, four assists, shot about 35% from three. So there you go. That's where we are at right now. You've got about, I guess, eight guys on the roster, maybe. Chris, just as you kind of look at where this past 5 days has taken us, what do you make of it?
Yeah, obviously a lot of action happening. There was a little bit of question of how quickly some of this would come with some dead period this and Final Four, and obviously all the coaches go to the Final Four and all of that. But There's a lot of moving pieces with this stuff. So, last year it was May before some guys got signed. So we may still be in a holding pattern a little bit here, with, kind of how news trickles out, we'll see. But, it's obviously guard heavy. You made the joke there that, the changing the guard, which I put in an article yesterday too, is like, we didn't know you meant literally, right? That we're gonna change guards constantly. But honestly, the way Ryan Odom wants to play, it makes sense to bring in a lot of guards first. All of them can shoot the three. So when the worst among you is a 36% career 3-point shooter, and that's on a lot of volume, that's not a handful of shots. Hall took a lot of threes at BYU and is at 36%. He's the lowest of the five guys. Now, we don't have college stats for career, right? But his little bit of international experience, he was at high 30s, low 40s on 3-point shooting as well. So it's pretty clear what they're going to be doing. They're going to be shooting a lot of threes, spacing the floor, driving and kicking, handoffs, into ball screens. There's just going to be a lot of movement on the floor, and that's going to be an adjustment period for some Virginia fans to watch, I think. But Virginia's taking a lot of threes anyway, even in the Tony Bennett era, even though it wasn't top 25 all the time or top 50 all the time. It was pretty much top half of the country all the time in terms of how many threes they took on average. But we'll see. We'll see how that pans out. Yeah, I tend to think of it as just a different way to try to beat people with less, so to speak, right? And it's not that Virginia has less. Some of these guys are have a whole lot of suitors, and three of the five played on teams that were in the NCAA tournament last year. So it's not like you're scraping the bottom of the transfer portal barrel here, but it's also not, you're not pulling a Cooper Flagg type. It's not anything like that either. So it'll be interesting to see how all this pans out.
Yeah, you mentioned the 3-point shooting, and that's kind of the first thing that people eyes kind of go to with all these different guys. They're all, high 30s, low 40s 3-point shooters. And at VCU, obviously, and kind of throughout his time as a coach, Ryan Odom's teams have taken a lot of threes, and VCU was 23rd in the country last year in 3-point attempts. And they didn't shoot well. So like they were taking threes even though they weren't shooting well. This team looks a lot more set up to shoot well. So maybe you're kind of combining last year's UVA team who shot a good percentage but didn't shoot a lot of threes, and maybe VCU who shot a lot of threes but didn't shoot a high percentage, and maybe that kind of evens out in the interim here.
I feel like I'm seeing some Virginia fans are worried about tempo, that they're just going to try to run and gun. And that's never worked, right? Like, we're in the same conference as Duke and North Carolina. That's never going to work. So I'm seeing that from fans a little bit. But to me, like, this is just a different way. And I kind of mentioned that, right? This is a different way to try to beat teams. It's the Princeton kind of idea. Everybody on the floor can shoot, everybody on the floor is moving. Can you guard all of that? Right. It's not necessarily all fast breaks, one pass Phoenix Sun style where you shoot in less than 7 seconds. It's not those kind of threes all the time. Can that work? Right. Can you shoot a high volume of threes, make a high volume of threes? And that puts a lot of pressure on the other team, regardless of how good their players are. Right. Like BYU, Alabama. Right. That both obviously have a pretty high NIL budget. So I'm not saying that one's different than the other, but it's that type of vibe for the fans that watch the NCAA tournament. It's going to be some fast breaks, but really trying to beat you with a specialty. Right. In Bennett's case, that was backline defense. Right. And tempo. In this case, it sounds like it's going to be beat you with a specialty, threes, shoot a lot of threes, make a lot of threes.
Yeah. And that seems to be kind of the analytic heavy model that we're seeing in a lot of college programs right now. And a lot of people, you talked about people talking about pace, and Virginia obviously has been known for having one of the slower paces in the country these past couple of years. And VCU only like 240, which 100 spots is it's still going to look noticeable. You're going to see an uptempo pace, but in the past he's been fat. His teams have been faster at Utah State and even at VCU, and it's kind of fluctuated based on the team. And it was interesting. And we talked about this last week on the podcast with Zach Carey, but Ryan Odom said in his Field of 68 interview that he wants to run faster, but he wants to keep kind of their defensive principles. And VC was finished fifth last year, defensive efficiency. So defense is still really important to him. So he's not going to just abandon that side of the floor. But I will expect them to be maybe even a tick faster than what they were at VCU, just because of the level of guards that you're getting in here. And another thing on the guards is everyone's like, all right, we got enough guard. They were saying they had enough guards after they got three transfers. And I was like, just wait, because like Ryan Odom goes deep into his benches. Like I was going back and looking through his teams. Almost every year, he has at least nine players playing more than 10 minutes a game. And so he goes deep into his bench. There's even years where he had 13, 12 guys. I don't think a 12, 13 man rotation is sustainable, but I think, it shows that he needs a lot of depth. And so I would even expect another guard or two to come in this transfer portal cycle, and at least to have, four big men probably by the end of it. But you're going to shuffle a lot of guards in there because you're playing three of them at a time, most likely every, kind of every lineup.
Yeah, I think there's some hints in there about what's being pitched, right? Like, because of the type of guys that are coming in. There are two things you got to keep in mind. One, like, not everyone can be a starter, right? When you're putting 10 players on the roster, that math doesn't add up. There's only five starting spots. You can't recruit everyone as a starter. And they have to know that coming in, right? Their agents and them as players know Virginia is adding 10 players, right? Like, give or take. So they know that. And it's probably being pitched as you're going to have to compete for minutes. But ultimately, I play 9 or 10 guys. You're looking at 25 minutes a game, give or take, instead of 37 minutes a game from someone like Kihei Clark or Reese Beekman or something like that. That's 12 minutes. That's a lot of minutes that can be spread around multiple players. So I think there's definitely some hints in here that what's being pitched is we're going to roll guards, like Tony Elliott keeps saying, we're going to roll the defensive line. We're going to roll guards in there and keep coming at you and just see how teams can handle that. And if you can play hard for your 20 to 25 minutes, you're going to get a lot of shots. We're going to play reasonably fast. We talk pace. 100 spots is 5 possessions a game, 5 or 6 possessions a game. And that's just on average, right? So there are going to be times that that's going to feel way faster. Just so, even though it's only 5 or 6 possessions, I have a feeling that's going to feel significantly faster. Just what Virginia fans have gotten used to.
And you talk about just the lineups, and someone asked me, like, oh, after Dalen Hall committed, like, oh, how's he gonna fit into this now? Like, is he a backup? And I'm like, we're so quick to try to like fit these guys into a depth chart. Like, you can't make a depth chart right now. You kind of have to like look at the bigger picture once they have this entire lineup built out, because they don't even have it in the front court right now. So like, who are you sliding in there right now in this, make-believe depth chart? But yeah, I think it's gonna shuffle a lot of guys in and out. Like you said, like they want to press, and so you got to have a lot of guys to be able to do that consistently through a game. And they want to, run a little bit faster at tempo. So, this is a really talented backcourt. We can talk about some of the guys individually, as I know you've written a lot of the stories about their commitments and everything, what you've seen. I like a lot of these guys, and I do have a piece on mid-major talent that I want to get to later. But who is someone that's really kind of stood out to you among these guys that have committed?
I mean, I think you probably start with Jakari White just because he took 7 threes a game. That's a ton of volume. Obviously scored a lot coming from the Summit League. So you wonder, how does that translate? I mean, I think it's fair to wonder that. A lot of guys are moving up, though, in the Power Five feeder system now that it's become. So, but also over 2 assists a game. So he wasn't just jacking shots, had a lot of suitors. Had a final five that Virginia wasn't in, and then ends up at Virginia. So, I mean, I think I start there because I think he's an intriguing player. It's 1 year. This is not a multi-year eligibility, and th at least three of these guys fit into that puzzle where they're only going to be here for a year. So, that they're going to come in, I would assume, focused and hungry, because they're trying to make an impression. So, not just make money as much as fans are disillusioned with that. Like, yes, they're making money. Don't get me wrong. They're making a lot of money with the numbers that are being thrown around. But some of these guys are still chasing that pro dream, right? Can I show in Power Four that I got it? Jakari White definitely seems to have the ability to be a volume scorer. So I start from there. But There are other guys that have put up a lot of points per game at previous stops too, that are similar to the Summit League in terms of Toledo and High Point earlier in Duke Miles' career. So, yeah, you have multiple guys that look like they can fill it up. So then my question just becomes, yeah, there's only one basketball. So are you willing to share it? Are you willing to take the best shots? And all that remains to be seen. We need to see what the whole roster looks like and how that pans out. But that's a Ryan Odom and company problem, right? Get as many ingredients as you can and then get them all on the same page as best as you can. But yeah, I start there. That volume is really jumps off the page. Seven threes a game is a lot.
And he's a three level scorer, just going through some of the tape on him. Like, he can score in a lot of different ways, and a lot of those threes are come out of isolation, but off the dribble. But some of those are also catch and shoot, so he can do it in a couple different ways. And at 6'3", you can create a shot, and he has a little bit of, passing and setting up other guys in his game. He averaged about, well, a little over 2 assists a game, so he can do some off the ball, secondary ball handling stuff for Virginia. And that's, you mentioned there's only one ball. That's why I love a transfer like Dalen Hall. Like, this is a guy that, he'll take his shots, but he's not necessarily looking for his shots. His first thing is he's trying to set everyone else up, and that's why he's averaged right around 5 assists for most of his career. Can really set guys up, and it's kind of like Andrew Rohde last year, who mainly was looking to set other guys up and had racked up some good assist numbers. But Hall, really good athlete. I don't know if you saw the alley-oop dunk video that was going around social media, but I was like, okay, I didn't know he was like that. And that's another thing, is like, this is a much more athletic backcourt that we're seeing Virginia bring in. And that kind of follows Ryan Odom's whole MO. On the point guard stuff, Duke Miles, Dalen Hall, maybe, like I said, Jakari White, some off secondary off ball handling, and then Chance Mallory. That's kind of your ball handling situation right now. How do you see that playing out?
So I'm of the mindset similar to what Coach Bennett had done for so long, that it's a little bit about who initiates a given possession, right? Like point guard, unless you're running everything through them, and that happens depending on what your roster makeup looks like. Kihei Clark 2020, right? He was the ball
Everything.
handler, right? So it can work out in different ways, but when you have multiple people that can handle the ball, it just becomes about whatever you're doing on that particular possession, unless you're being pressed, and then you're going to want a primary ball handler. But again, if you have multiples, that's not a bad thing because if they trap the first pass, it becomes about the secondary ball handler anyway. One reason that Virginia had the point guard inbound for so long is first pass gets trapped, you throw it right back to the point guard. So, a little bit of it is whatever semantics, like, which player you want to call the point guard. But I'm curious by Hall in this scenario because last year at BYU, it sounds like he was off the ball more than he was the previous year. And the previous year, he was top 25, top 30 in the country in assist to turnover ratio. So Reese Beatman was number 21. Hall was like number 26, I think, about off the top of my head. So this is someone who sets the table without turning the ball over. And if you're going to play faster, not fast, but faster, you need guys who make good decisions and who can set the table. So that he really kind of jumps off the page with that to me. And then others will be more. Yeah, like whether it's BYU style, Kentucky style last year with Mark Pope, Mike Young at Virginia Tech, you're going to have a lot of deals where one guard goes and hands it off to another guard, and that guard comes flying off of a ball screen right after getting that. There's going to be those type of actions. All of these guys need to be able to handle it a little bit because of the way Ryan Odom wants to play, whether you call them the point guard or not.
And looking back at last year's VCU team, they had five guys average right around 2 assists. So, like, they spread the wealth as far as who's the playmaker and who's making plays out there. Max Scholga is the one that actually led them, and he's not a point guard. He's an off-ball scorer, and but he certainly had a lot of playmaking responsibilities for that VCU team. So I would expect the same thing, like you're saying. I think they're going to kind of divvy that up and see where that goes. It's interesting. And then another guy that probably is the most intriguing, just because he has 2 years of eligibility, is Sam Lewis. 6'6" wing out of Toledo, shoots really well. And just looking at it, he's got some ability to put the ball on the floor and score. He's not a great at the rim finisher, like some of the other guys in this class right now, but he certainly offers a lot of versatility just because of his size at 6'6", and to be able to shoot 44%, like, that's a guy that, if he plays his cards right the next couple of years, he's got an NBA future, because 6'6" shooting wings are, all the rage.
There's a lot of those type of guys out there. So those spots are obviously competitive both at the power
Yeah.
four level and at the NBA level. But versatility is something you're going to need. One, depending on the style you're playing, right? So everything we were just saying, multiple guys are going to touch it. So you need versatility. But I also just think the way a lot of things trend at the power four level, you have a lot of sort of four-ish guards lineups that happen a lot, right? You know,
Yeah.
small ball with DeAndre Hunter at the four, he's 6'8", right? Like Devin Hall comes to mind. He was around that 6'5", 6'6" size, like Sam Lewis. A little bit of a combo guard, combo forward, sort of playmaking high school point guard. You know what I mean? Like that Devin Hall played so well. So there are a lot of different ways that teams throw things at you,
Yeah.
particularly within the ACC, right? You saw a lot of that vibe this year, a lot of 6'7", 6'8", 6'9". Guys, you know, like trying to deal with the Cooper Flag and trying to deal with different players like that. You know, so you need versatile players. 6'6" is not huge. It's big. It's not
Yeah.
huge. So can he move all the way down and be the fourth guard in a four guard lineup? You know, I don't know about that. We'll see. Without seeing more of it, but he definitely has a little bit of that versatile feel, like a Kyle Anderson maybe from Slow Mo. I don't know. He really it was his nickname in college,
Yeah.
in his early days in the NBA. So he's got that look to him to me, kind of like finds a way to get the job done, basically. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, he's also only like I think just over 200 pounds, so yeah, you maybe he can go down to the four. But yeah, like you said, like this has been a thing forever, and I know a lot of people get f so fixated on height and size and everything, and some people are like translating it to the NBA where it's like, oh well, like this guy's 6'6", he can only play the two guard because you need like a 6'8", 6'9" guy at the wing. And I'm like, that doesn't happen in college basketball that often if you really look at it. Like maybe some like good NBA prospects come along and like they're in that kind of wing range, but it doesn't happen all that often. A lot of times you're going to see a lot more small ball. And I kind of always think back to those early and you know even some late Jay Wright teams with the with how they played four guards, like kind of four around one, and they would have the one big man who sometimes is only like 6'7" if you look back to Dante Cunningham on those teams. Like so that's kind of what I see. You made an interesting point earlier, and it's something that I kind of see, maybe not at the same pace, but you kind of compared it to Mark Pope and his teams at BYU and Kentucky. And been getting a lot of the same vibes. You know, we'll see if it has this instant success, but what Mark Pope did with kind of how he built his roster, and you can kind of talk about the X's and O's, but there's no like stars on that Kentucky roster. They all kind of came in, and it was a lot of 10 man rotation, a lot of guys going in, but all good basketball players. They had just a roster of really good basketball players, and that's kind of what, you know, led them to the season. And Otega Owe for them, he kind of turned into the go-to guy, and you kind of have to have a guy turn into that. But if you just get 10 really good basketball players out on the court, you're going to do pretty well.
Florida is a little bit of that too. Houston was a
Yeah.
little bit of that. That was obviously the national title game. They have stars, obviously, like who are guys who became stars, but when they were building those rosters, you know, not necessarily. Some Florida, I don't think had any top 100 guys in terms of high school rankings,
Yeah.
right? So, not that that matters as much when you're not recruiting high school at the power four level quite as heavily as in the past. So, it'll be interesting. I tend to think of wingspan and toughness more than height and weight. You know what I mean? Like Jordan Minor wasn't tall, but as soon as they put him in the lineup, he was able to absorb a guy like DJ Burns better because he was just tougher
Yeah.
than some other options. And his rankings weren't very high. He came out of a small conference and all that. And he wasn't a star, but Jordan Minor was able to provide you a certain thing. And when I look at it, you know, guys that come in, I go, okay, what's your wingspan? You know, great, you're 6'6" at the top of your head, but you know, a lot of these guys are 6'6", but they're 6'9" wingspan. You know, and that's where you're trying to go block the ball with or trying to hit the ball with. So, like, I just feel like that matters more. And then just competitive toughness. You know, like at times last year and some recent years, you wanted more of that from Virginia, right? Like, I'm not saying it was lukewarm. There was just something about it, like a cautiousness to it,
Yeah.
almost a cautiousness to the competitiveness. And what Kentucky was doing as your point of reference is a little bit of that. We're just going to come at you, 8, 9, 10 guys, and keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. So, you know, Ryan Odom's background and history, and you look at his dad and how some of those teams played, and even the UMBC upset and all of that, there was definitely a little competitive toughness, a little chip on the shoulder vibe if you watch his teams play. And you put a guy like that into a place like Virginia where there is a little bit of that still, even with a national title, like because you're in Duke's conference, you're not the one. You know what I mean? You're never going to be the man, so to speak. It's always going to be Duke. So you have a little bit of that chip on your shoulder, and you put a guy like that in that environment, what can he do with it?
Wow. I want to make another point too here about the way these transfers are committing. None of them have visited grounds. So, like, there is a major unpredictability about how this kind of roster building is going about right now. Like, some of them you've seen interest with, like Sam Lewis, they were interested in him. Jakari White, there was some initial interest, but then he like took them out and he had just his top five and they were not included in that. And then, it seems like sometimes it just kind of comes out of nowhere with this recruiting cycle right now. It's not as predictable as before with like I feel like in the last couple of transfer portal cycles for Virginia, you're like, all right, I know they're interested in TJ Power, they're interested in Elijah Saunders.
And they're waiting to schedule a visit.
Yeah, they're waiting to schedule a visit. We'll see maybe in 5 days, draft your tweets, get ready. The commitment's probably coming at this day or whatever. Right now with Virginia, and I think even I'm a huge fan of the new Double Bang video, the kind of teaser graphic that Virginia's doing. I don't think they know when to post it right now because like they'll post it like after a transfer, they'll post it, hours and hours before a transfer commits. There's an unpredictability even with, Virginia when they're teasing this stuff right now, which is just hilarious, but huge fan of Mike Breen. So anytime I can get a Double Bang, whenever on a Wednesday morning, like I'll take it. Let's look at, kind of the rest of this roster building and kind of how Ryan Odom's gonna finish out this class. A couple other things that are coming up down the pike. Kansas wing Rakees Passmore, who was a former top recruit at Kansas, and he's visiting this week. I tend to, put less stock into a visit now just because of what we've seen. UVA also heavy interest, and this is kind of the one that's kind of hanging out there right now. In San Francisco guard Malik Thomas, nothing's happened yet. This has just been all the chatter on message boards, on social media. There's been some pretty credible stuff about it. I think even On Threes, Pete Nakos put a prediction in for Malik Thomas to go to UVA. We'll see what happens with that. Again, we're recording this podcast on Thursday morning. So if something happens, I'm sorry. This is the pain of recording. And then obviously everyone wants to keep saying, the front court. We need front court players. Why aren't they recruiting the front court? I'm like, I think they are recruiting the front court. I don't think they're planning to play Chance Mallory at center this year. I think they are trying to get players in there. But how do you just see kind of the rest of this roster building going?
So one, just starting with those two names you mentioned, I wonder if that's a first come, first serve deal. You know what I mean? I don't know if they take both, other than the fact that Thomas, obviously, you maybe take no matter what. I don't know if you take Passmore no matter what. Like if you go ahead and get Thomas, do you keep pushing on Passmore? No. If you get, I don't think so. I could be wrong. Certainly, I could be wrong. I'm still learning how the staff
I tend to
operates.
agree with you, yeah.
But if you get Passmore, I do think you would still take Thomas. So who knows how that'll play out? You mentioned On Three. He reported some sort of market value stuff that I think helps contextualize front court. All right. So Nakos wrote that point guards are anywhere from 500,000 to 2.5 million for high level players. Wings are anywhere from 800,000 to 2 million for high level players. So I feel like that's where you're starting because these are your higher level players. Because when you go look at forwards and centers, according to Nakos, it's more between 1.5 and 1.8 million, sort of on average at the power four level for the front court versus maybe as much as 2 million for guards. So I think there's a little bit of salary cap management going on here, even though there is no cap, right? They're trying to figure out, what do you need to pursue first with whatever resources they have, which we are not 100% clear on even what that number is. It's very clearly not what people thought it was. I think you can say that pretty safely at this point. The Toledo Blade reported this morning that where Sam Lewis came over from Toledo, the number they heard from him was north of a million. And right now you got people making depth charts with him coming off the bench. So, and like you said earlier, you can't make a depth chart because these guys have to come in and compete and we'll see what happens. But the fact that that's even possible, hopefully will help frame, what people are looking at here. The front court, they may have been figuring out, okay, how much additional capital do we have once we get the most important piece? And I'm not downing the front court, but if he wants to guard three quarter court, full court man, or press and trap some, or even just play half court in your face defense, you got to start on the perimeter first, right? Because it doesn't matter who's behind them if you can't guard the guys out on the perimeter. That's where the ball starts every possession. It doesn't start in the paint. You know what I mean? It starts bringing the ball up the court. So you got to have those guys first. And if you want to shoot a lot of threes, you got to have those guys first. So to me, this feels like prioritizing what you want your roster to look like or what your system is going to look like. And then you trickle down from there. I suspect we'll see anywhere from two to four bigs when this is all said and done. And I would expect them to be either in the Villanova mold, like you were saying, 6'9"-ish with wingspan, or guys who are just super, super big that rim protect. And obviously the VCU guy is the one that comes immediately everyone's mind. Is he coming? Is he coming? We'll see. But because he did take a visit,
Yeah, he was there.
did visit. Pretty easy to visit an hour away, I guess. But we'll just see. But I think this is just a roster priority thing versus ignoring the front court thing. It's about what the going market is for each position, what your budget is, and then what you want your system to look like.
Yeah, and this just seems like a very analytical, how do we get the best bang for our buck? How do we make this NIL money stretch out? Who do we target first? Like you're saying, like this just seems like very analytically driven. And that's what, Wally Walker, who's kind of acting as the GM right now, putting this roster, said, like they are using an outside analytics company to help build this roster, which has become a big trend in college basketball across the land. Alabama's used it. Duke even used it. I don't know how much analytics you need to tell you that Cooper Flagg's a really good player. Just go put some good shooters around him. But, they use the analytics as well. And so this is a common thing. Texas Tech, who, kind of had a really similar kind of roster rebuild with Grant McCaslin coming in there, they're doing it too. So this seems like kind of they're looking at what's the best value, where's the biggest investment, what's going to make the most sense for our play style, and how do we kind of set this roster up.
And then the other piece there is they're still waiting on the house settlement. There's the theory that this year you better spend money because there may be limits on it in future years, or at least a clearing house for legit NIL deals. We'll see how much water that holds. But there's at least some theory out there that the market values are higher this year because these schools want to spend the donor money that they have, not a rainy day fund for next year or 2 years from now. That's part one. Part two is you have an entire roster to build. You have to spend more money this year, and you hope that you structured in a way that some of these guys are multiple year guys so that you're not filling 10 spots every year. You fill 10 this year, you lose three, four, five of them as 1 year guys, and then you only fill in three or four next year, plus maybe a couple of those are high school recruits, et cetera, et cetera. So that's still kind of hanging there too. It's a different year versus what future years might look like.
Chris, you mentioned just the total roster rebuild that Ryan Odom and the staff are going through right now. And it seems like we're just kind of at a point right now where it seems pretty much like a clean break from the Tony Bennett era. As far as the roster right now, there's one, two players that are still on there from last year's roster, but no, zero returning minutes currently right now. And I know Elijah Saunders had kind of put out his list right now, and it still includes Virginia. So there's a possibility that he returns. But as of right now, about as clean a break as there can be as a roster wise. And then we get this kind of coaching staff news where earlier this week, Kyle Guy and Isaiah Wilkins both made separate posts announcing that, they will not be part of Ryan Odom's staff, and kind of all the reports that are out there, and make point of mentioning Zach Carey's report that he put out there that both were offered opportunities to stay on Ryan Odom's staff. And it seems like, and it kind of Kyle Guy alluded to in his post, that there is another opportunity out there for both of these guys. So Ryan Odom talked a lot about at his introductory press conference about kind of wanting to have that tie to, the past, and kind of having one of those alums maybe not these alums, but an alum on staff like he had done at VCU. But it seems like it won't be either of these guys, as he still has one assistant coach spot left open as they announced kind of the rest of his coaching staff earlier this week.
So I'm not overly surprised by that. He did try to offer them spots. We don't know what those spots were,
That's
what those
true.
roles were, right? Remember, Kyle Guy's role was basically just created out of thin air, right? And he became a guy who was allowed to coach on the court, for however the how the you can title whatever you want to title someone, and then you have X amount of people that are allowed to coach on the court, and certain people allowed to recruit on campus versus off campus, etc. But regardless, his title was created out of nowhere. It was a non-existent title, and then it was here. So that's part one. You would have to figure out how you're going to fit that into your new staff structure. He does have other guys coming that are not assistant coaches, analytics and et cetera, that Virginia did not title previously. They do have people in-house that were doing those things, right? Johnny Carpenter, before he left, was doing those types of things. So, title it whatever you want, but you have those people coming in. So that part of it is there. And like you said, there is one official assistant spot open as well. It would not surprise me if that ends up being someone with Virginia ties. Doesn't have to be. I speculated from the beginning that Orlando Vandross was one to keep an eye on just because they worked together at Charlotte. That would technically be a tie to the last staff. So, even though he was brought in, halfway through the 15-year run or whatever. So, we'll see. And I haven't heard anything that Vandross is under consideration. I'm not trying to put that out there as a report. I'm just saying that's an example of a route that could happen. J.R. Reynolds is in Division One coaching. That's a tie to the past that is well liked by Virginia fans and is a little farther back and kind of bridges the pre-Bennett and post Jeff Jones, Terry Holland eras, right? So, we'll just have to see how all of this pans out.
And David Teal, when he was on here before, kind of right after Ryan Odom's introductory press conference, he mentioned, and it may not be one of those guys. It could be someone like an Anthony Solomon from Notre Dame, who has had, past ties to the area in Virginia, and could be, a number of other, players that are out there that have coaching ties.
Brian Smith.
Brian Smith is the other one that he mentioned. What about you mentioned Johnny Carpenter earlier. Memphis just fired their coach. Who knows what they're going to do in that situation? And again, none of this is reporting. We're just speculating on
No,
names.
speculation time.
Speculating on names that would fit that ties to the Virginia program kind of
And he is
role,
highly
but
thought of as an up and comer in the coaching ranks. So
yeah, absolutely. So
Junior Burrow is a high school coach. That has stayed aware of the program, does radio interviews locally here sometimes with Luke Neer. So there are people out there that have connections to the past. It's just not necessarily the Bennett past, in part because some of those guys are just not that old yet,
that's true.
right? Like they haven't been in the coaching ranks that long yet.
And I will say, for as great as Tony Bennett was and as good as many good assistants as he had over the years, a lot of those guys were there for a long time, and there isn't really a coaching tree that really branched out. Obviously, Ron Sanchez left, and then he came back. The only other guy that kind of comes to mind is like Richie McKay, who's obviously a sitting head coach at Liberty, just signed a contract extension there. So like there's not a ton of like branches out there for recent UVA guys in the coaching ranks right now. And like you said, a lot of them are young, if they're players, and a lot of the coaches have kind of been around or might be retiring now, or they're kind of on the back end of their careers. So and again, I don't think anyone's saying, this isn't something that like we're saying that, oh, he has to have some tie to the program on the staff. We're not saying that. I think he'd be fine not having that, but he's the one that said that at his introductory press conference. That's something he likes to do. And it is an interesting point too. I was going back and looking at his VCU coaching staffs because he talked about bringing some guys in there, like a Darius Theus, who is now following him to Virginia to be on this coaching staff, or Bradford Burgess, who was on his coaching staff and was staying down at VCU. Those guys weren't there when he got to VCU. He went out and found them and brought them back to VCU, to their alma maters. So I think a lot of focus was put on Kyle Guy and Isaiah Wilkins for obvious reasons, because I think they are young coaches in the business that have a very recent and very like visual past with Virginia that a lot of people connect to, and they made an effort, it seems like, to keep them. But maybe it is something where it's a guy that we're not even thinking about right now to kind of fill that last spot.
This is no offense to Isaiah, but a lot of this is about Kyle
Yes.
for fans. And I don't mean that as any slight to Isaiah at all, because I'm a big fan of Isaiah Wilkins. But in fact, I think I called him the ghost when he was here. You remember that the Patriot with Mel Gibson, the Benjamin Martin character is called the ghost because he's everywhere. Isaiah Wilkins was everywhere that last year on defense. So huge fan. But when you come to fans and being obsessed with former players, period, whether they're coaches or not, Kyle Guy is obviously a folk hero. Let's be honest, he's a folk hero. He stood on the line in front of 6 trillion people watching worldwide or whatever the number was and knocked three free throws down. Like, obviously, you want that guy around, right? If you're a Virginia fan. So a lot of it is just because of that, right? We'll see how this pans out. Chase Coleman has not said anything. Is he still what's his graduate assistant role like? There's lots of guys out there who have worn this uniform that maybe you're not even thinking of. So we'll see. And he has a long time, right? So remember who was sitting in the audience there? Jeff Jones, Dave Odom, on down the list there of former players that have different connections in the coaching world than just the recent Virginia tree. So we'll see.
I think they will. I don't think this coaching staff is done. I think they will continue to hire for a couple other roles. Like they still, I know, want to hire a general manager because I don't think they, or Wally Walker wants to kind of take that role on for the long term. So I think they're still hiring for this coaching staff. We'll see where it kind of goes. And if they do have end up hiring someone that has ties to the program, and also at the end of the day, like you got to think Ryan Odom's a guy that has ties to the program too for over the long term. That's one of the reasons, not the reason, but one of the reasons Carla Williams said they hired him and liked him so much because of his, just knowledge of the program and culture and everything. Griff Ulbrich has some ties as being a UVA law alum, so they have ties. And then obviously you're bringing back Mike Curtis and Ethan Saliba, so they're your ties right there. I think combined over 60 years of experience on in this men's basketball program.
Yeah, Ethan Saliba connects all the arrows.
Yeah, there you go.
Pick your head coach. Ethan Saliba has a connection to that at Virginia. So there's definitely institutional knowledge that is built in there. And everyone likes Ethan Saliba. I've never heard anyone say,
No.
right? Like that guy is well liked, regardless of which era you're talking about.
Retaining both of those guys was just kind of like, yeah, of course of course you keep those guys. Like if unless they had offers to go elsewhere, and obviously I think they're pretty comfortable in Charlottesville. I think you keep those guys no matter what. The last thing is, I think some people are like, oh, Odom's just making a clear cut from the Tony Bennett era, kind of go his own way. I don't think that's necessarily how he wanted it to play out. I think there were some players that he wanted to keep. I think there were some coaches that he wanted to keep, obviously, and it just didn't work out that way. But I don't think there's any, like, he's not trying to just kind of whitewash the past of Tony Bennett in the last 15 years of UVA basketball. I think if anyone has a respect for it, it's him.
If fans look at things through their own lens, and fans see things a lot of different ways. Like, and they're still fans. They still love the program, right? Like, so some people love the grind it out. Some people hated the grind it out. Some, embrace the pace or speed up the pace, right? Like, whatever it is you want to talk about, fans have a different view on it. So it's not surprising that some fans are a little bit like, what? Is this a complete clean cut? Oh my goodness, what is he doing? Just, it comes with the territory.
And Tony Elliott tried to do that with Bronco Mendenhall. He kept a couple of those coaches around, offensive line coach Garrett Toujae, and obviously the big one, wide receivers coach Marcus Hagans. Both those guys within, a year were gone.
And Clint as
So,
well. Clint sent him as well.
and Clint
So,
sent him, he was gone within 2 years.
right. So, I mean, even if he kept guys, we'll see. And that goes with anybody on in the coaching or support staff or whatever. Some of these people are going to probably want to move on at some point if they're trying to climb the coaching ranks. Whereas Ryan Odom, this is probably his stop if everything goes the way he wants it to go.
And I think back then with Marcus Hagans, it was a great opportunity for him to kind of get out and experience something new and go to a program like Penn State, which was in the college football playoff last year. I think that was good for him, and it could be good for Kyle Guy and Isaiah Wilkins to kind of get some different experiences if they want to continue to push and pursue this coaching career. Chris, I think we covered a lot of basketball. I'm sure this will be dated by the time we post it just in a couple hours. I'm sure there'll be some more transfers coming in. But thanks for coming on. Coming up next, we got Eric Ward from UVA as the assistant director of marketing there at UVA. So stay tuned for that conversation coming up here after the break.
On the field, winning comes from hard work, care, and preparation. I learned that that same hard work doesn't stop when we exit the arena. Your care is our commitment, and preparation is our promise. We tackle challenges head on and turn dreams into reality, which is why I'm excited to join the team at Alcova Mortgage, where we help you score the perfect home.
Hello and welcome back into the Who's On podcast, part of the Sabre Podcast Network. We are turning our eyes to spring football because the spring game at Scott Stadium is this Saturday. And to talk a little bit about the spring game and some other things going on with UVA football and everything fan-wise, we got Eric Ward, Assistant Athletics Director for Marketing, joining us here today. Eric, big thanks for coming on the program.
Preston, thanks so much for having me.
Let's look at the spring game because I know that's the big ticket on the item right now for you guys. And amidst all the things that are going on in the spring with, you know, baseball, lacrosse, and all the other spring sports as well. But with spring football, what is this game like for you guys just kind of setting it up and kind of what are the expectations for this year?
Yeah, look, thank you for asking. I'm looking forward to the spring game. I think it's always for us a really good kind of halfway point of the offseason. A lot of prep work goes into leading up to the spring game, but it's sort of go mode after to get ready for the season. Great opportunity to see fans kind of experience the game day and dust off the cobwebs per se. But I'm looking forward to seeing the team. We obviously have a lot of new faces this year, and I think that's of heavy interest to a lot of people, myself included. I know some of them will be playing, some of them will not, but it's always good to see fresh faces and kind of get a preview of the season. And I think there's going to be a lot of folks that are very interested in seeing that this year.
Yeah, how does it feel like just going into it? I know, obviously, at the end of last season, I keep saying, you know, after that walking out of Lane Stadium in the cold, everyone was kind of like down, and then kind of the transfer portal and, you know, the big NIL donations and everything kind of spiked interest back up. So how does it feel going into this game?
I think it feels good. I mean, I will say I'm a lifelong fan of the Hoos, right? So like it is tough when you lose that game. It's frustrating. It's very frustrating for the coaches and the players. To rebound in such a big way that they did, I think, is impressive. I know we had a lot of support from some fans and donors that has made a substantial difference and has put us in a far more competitive place. That part is very refreshing to see. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing kind of how it shapes together. I know, like, if you speak to Coach Elliott and his players, they have a very specific vision of the program. They're very committed to staying the course and navigating through many challenges, some known, some unknown. I think we're finally getting to a place where that playing field is starting to level out, and it's going to be nice to see them compete on that level playing field. You know, we will have some players that are not going to be in the spring game. Some of those guys I'm sure fans are very interested in seeing. I think the rosters are coming out today or tomorrow, so I'll be interested to see that. But, you know, the goal is to be healthy at our peak at the start of the season and be ready to go. So we'll be interested to see how that kind of shapes together. As far as the spring game itself, I mean, it's a cool opportunity to get in front of the fans. You know, football is a different experience depending on who you are, and spring game is an opportunity to kind of level set for everybody. The focus this year is just super fan friendly, lots of free events, lots of programming around it, and just provide an overall fun atmosphere for folks that are trying to get exposed to UVA football. Some diehards, some brand new.
Yeah, is it easier on your end when there is a little bit of juice going into this game?
No question. I mean, it is, I've worked at four different institutions, and spring games have very different values depending on that institution and different years. And I think it's fun for a lot of people for sure. But at the end of the day, it is an exhibition. So, you know, there's parts of it that are not the same. When you have such a huge roster change, that changes the dynamic quite a lot because you do get to see some of these new guys and preview it. And I'm sure the team will not be, you know, super, they're not going to, you know, throw away the whole playbook this year. They're not going to bring in a lot of new things into the playbook for this game, but I'm sure there'll be some wrinkles that people get to see and some fresh faces, whether they be first years coming on to the season, excuse me, or some of these transfer portal guys.
I know personally, from my perspective, writing and then also doing the podcast, it's almost like you're an NBA free agency right now. Like, for the longest time, everyone said the most interesting thing about the NBA is not the games being played, but it's all the talk around it. So
The
that's kind of
noise.
what it feels. That's what it feels like in college sports all over right now. But looking at specifically the spring game, what are some things that y'all have going on around the game?
Well, first of all, I do want to shout out Jeff White did an amazing piece this week on kind of that model and how it's changed. And I would encourage anybody to check that out. I think it shows sort of the changing paradigm of college athletics and how Virginia is approaching that. And kudos to Jeff. That was a really cool piece to put together. For the spring game specifically, the big one is the Fan Fest before the game. We're working in conjunction with the president's office to put on a really great community event. They have some banner events throughout the year, with the lighting of the lawn, the trick-or-treating on the lawn. They're trying to carve out kind of a spring event, and so I think we're going to try something this year around the spring game that's open to the community, very family friendly, inflatables, face painters, balloon artists, all that kind of stuff, like to the max. And some free food components to that too, live music, tailgate games, and just create more of a festive atmosphere. It's going to be from 9:30 to 11:45 on Saturday. Hopefully the weather holds off and we're going to be in good shape there. But that's something that we're gonna maximize this year, and it's going to be a lot of fun. But then some of the other components that are more standard to a game day, such as the Wahoo Walk, is going to be at 10:45 this weekend. Of course, the equipment sale, which is always piques the interest of a lot of folks. Season ticket members for football are going to get a 30-minute head start at that at 10:30. It opens up for the general public at 11 when the gates open. The game itself should be about 2 hours, and then there's going to be a post-game autograph session on the field, which is all this completely free to fans. So I know a lot of schools are kind of moving away from that model. This is a good opportunity for us to do something that's just a general thank you to the fan base, and I'm hoping to see a lot of folks there to take advantage of these different things.
Yeah, it is interesting just kind of seeing where the spring model kind of goes in the future. We've heard a lot of different talk, and Tony Elliott's talked about some of it, like having the opportunity to maybe play and scrimmage another team in the spring. That's something that's on there. I know the NCAA kicked out Colorado and Syracuse trying to do that this year, but there's attempts there, and maybe it wasn't a no never. It was kind of a no not this year kind of thing. So we'll see if that's something in the future, and other schools just getting rid of it completely, just kind of going classic OTA style like NFL. So we'll be interested to see where we go in the future. But speaking of the future, y'all did something kind of interesting this year. You started the Football Fan Council, and I want to talk a little bit about just first where the idea for this kind of was sparked from, and especially coming off last year, where I know kind of you had a bunch of home games toward the end of it with some declining attendance. Just where did this idea kind of spark from?
Well, Preston, thanks for asking about that. It's been something that, so I started a couple years ago, and it's been kicked around at least since I've been here as an opportunity. And I think I mentioned earlier, like I am a lifelong fan of Virginia. I grew up coming to games. I experienced the fan experience just like everybody else. My professional experience has been elsewhere, 12, 13 years working at other institutions in the SEC, the Big 12, the American. I definitely from afar saw many opportunities for improvement. Since starting here, it was surprising. There were definitely a few things that were very clear that needed to be addressed. And I'm just one piece of many cogs within the wheel of the athletic department, but it's been refreshing to see a commitment from my peers across the athletic department to say, hey, we need to come together and figure out ways to make this better. There are lots of great things that we do on game days. There's lots of reasons why people come to our games. But there's also reasons people don't come to our games. And I think that some of it is out of our control. I know there are a lot of people that will say, hey, you need to win games. Great. I think we all totally understand that that is a factor. And I think we all have high expectations for that happening this year and beyond. But there's also things that are within our control that could have and should have been better over many, many years. And, I'll say this as somebody who's followed the program. The fans didn't walk away en masse over 1 year, and they're not going to come back in 1 year. But we have to start right now in improving the product that we produce in Scott Stadium to get folks to keep coming back. The council itself was really kind of formalized that we were going to do this in this offseason before we even kicked off last year. We wanted to make sure that we took time to evaluate our fan experience over the course of the football season to make sure that we understood these are the strong points, these are the weak points. That way, when we got into the winter months, we could start to formulate an actual council to address specific topics. So when we went to the general fan base to select the the contingency of fans, the focus was on diversification of what people wanted to change. So we had it was great. I mean, hundreds of submissions. They were all like very intentional. Hey, I want to see this different. Most of them extremely positive with very specifics of like, this is what I want to see changed. And it was great for us because we were able to take to kind of sort fans into buckets and say, hey, this person really has ideas or frustrations with Wi-Fi and connectivity. This person is about concessions. This person is about sustainability, or I drive through Lynchburg to get to games and have issues with traffic. And we were able to get really granular with how much feedback we got as a starting point, and then kind of round it out with some different ways. So the working group is 14. Some are from here, some are from Richmond. We have representation from Northern Virginia, Southside, Roanoke, Tidewater, some out-of-staters. And then on the athletic side, myself and four others who kind of touch different components of the fan experience. Myself, who does, marketing and the in-game presentation. We have Jess Armistead, who is with the VAF, a Virginia grad, a longtime employee of the athletic department. Similarly, Mike Slamowitz, known as Slammer, who runs our video team and produces the Who Vision show. His team produces Who Vision for games. Another Virginia grad, longtime employee of the athletic department. We also have a couple of fresher faces. John Welch, who oversees our facilities, events, and operations. His crew oversees the event itself, the Aramark contract and relationship, RMC, different entities we work with, like state police. But he's been here a couple of years, so he has opportunities that he's seeing like that we could freshen up. And then Jen Madden, who oversees our sports properties team that sells the sponsorships. And I kind of split the difference. Like, I also have experience elsewhere, but I understand the Virginia market. And we think that this combination is going to be very successful because we think it's the best group of people to come together and really fully evaluate every part of the fan experience and turn over every rock that needs to be turned over to make this better.
You had your first meeting already, and I know they're put out the list of names and stuff. So some very familiar ones from social media, some people that people recognize. Just what was it like, kind of getting in a room and kind of going through the first kind of cut of like, all right, here's what we're gonna kind of be talking about over these next, how many ever months.
It was great. I mean, I think that the very first message that I delivered to the group was transparency is key, and that goes both ways. I understand that there's probably frustration from the fan base and not understanding why decisions are made, and I think it's very valid. And I think we've done a really good job at starting this fan council on the note that we need to make everything available for people to understand the decision-making process and also contribute to making those decisions and understanding that. We have a lot of great insights in this room of people who have different experiences and touch game days in different ways as a fan that maybe we don't see. And I think that the other side of that is the fans being very comfortable with sharing their frustrations, sharing high points, low points, relaying information to us from other fans, relaying information from us to fans outwardly. And I think it was an encouraging first start. That was like how we started the first meeting. Of course, we had introductions and everybody got to kind of hear what folks were passionate about. And then the meeting was a very deep dive into data and analytics of everything that we do on these post-game surveys. When I started here a couple years ago, I standardized the survey so that we could have year-over-year comparisons. I think that was an area that we saw some improvement, and it was helpful to be able to benchmark against different areas. Some things are improving, some things have declined. For example, I think that consistently concessions quality has been an area that people identify as a challenge. I know that the athletics department has hired Aramark's S&E division to come in. Last year was sort of their first year with football. I think there were some tangible things we did see in the surveys. There were an improvement, and there were definitely some things that we saw that need to be addressed. So I'm looking forward to later on when we do get to a concession-specific meeting to talk about that. That I think we'll have a lot of quality feedback to be able to take in. But the meeting was very deep, excuse me, a deep dive into the specific data points of literally everything that we have from the surveys and showing those trends. And then the other side of it was there's a survey that goes out each year that benchmarks us against the ACC. And so our peer institutions in the conference that were able to say, here's how we stack up against it, and really just demonstrate this is the data that we receive, this is the feedback we receive from the fans. And help, to set the table for the many discussions to come that are much more pointed. And then the conclusion of the meeting, and since we've just had very open dialogue, open channel, these folks all have my phone number, all of our phone numbers, emails, to just continue to pour information into us so that we can log all this and get it to the correct officials in athletics.
Has it been surprising to you just any of the areas that, people are like focused on? Because I mean, you said one thing there is like the Wi-Fi, and like I know as a media member going to these games, sometimes I get frustrated with the Wi-Fi. I think there was one game last year where it like shut down for the whole second half, so I just remember us all just sitting there watching the game. And I remember as a kid, because I grew up going to UVA games, like it was like a cell block for Verizon. Like you could not get any signal in that stadium. Once you're in the stadium, you could not get any signal. But I get off my point there. But are there surprising areas that you've kind of heard about since you started this process?
I wouldn't say anything is a surprise. I think that we're all well aware of some of the sore spots. I think that the goal of the fan council is to help prioritize which ones need to be immediately addressed, which ones are, poorly communicated, and maybe help prioritize for some things such as Wi-Fi that may involve some major capital campaigns. I don't know the specific numbers because this isn't necessarily my part of the athletic department, but I know there are officials from Verizon, AT&T, et cetera, on site every single game day evaluating sore spots in the stadium, the DAS points, the Ting connectivity. That's an issue, but to completely redo that in Scott Stadium is a several millions of dollars gift that I'm sure at some point will be done. I don't know how soon, but. It's helpful to hear this from the fans to be able to kind of stack these things up one after another and say, hey, here's number one that needs to be fixed. Number two, because the reality is we can't necessarily fix every single thing in one year. I think that my assessment coming in is that there's probably a great many years of things on the decline. And the group we have together now is charged with climbing it back up. And that's not an excuse, but it is a challenge and something that we want to do. I'm really, encouraged by the fan council and being able to help us stack those up in order so that we can provide our administration a very clear directive from the fan base on here's exactly what we want to see and when.
I think one of the big topics last season that got a lot of people talking was the Hill, and kind of some of the different changes there. Is that something y'all are looking at again as you go into the next season?
Yeah, I think that and forgive me because I wasn't necessarily part of a lot of those conversations. That's definitely more of an operational thing, but I can summarize it that I think there were questions leading up to the season that the execution was not great. And I think that has been addressed in a gazillion different ways. And in fact, John, in the first fan council meeting, we actually talked about this, the Hill policies and procedures last year, how it came to be, and how it was changed as we got to the end of the season. There's several components to it, one of which was a fire code situation. It is one of the only venues, facilities on all the grounds of UVA that essentially could be out of control, right? We have no way to manage the space. That was a main impetus for the access points. I think that the implementation of the access points had the best intention, but I don't know if it was implemented successfully for a variety of different ways. And I think that the folks who oversee that would agree with that. They took it upon themselves after the Maryland game to reach out to several key leaders within the student body and said, hey, this was not good. How can we make it better? And as we got to the back half of the year, it was much better. I think that will be something that continues to see tweaks. But I think that we got to a really good spot at the end of the year where we felt good. The challenge is going to be when we get to capacity situations with the Hill again, which presumably will happen game one. Does that plan work and how will it be changed in real time to affect it? And that's something that I'm looking forward to continuing to discuss with this fan council group because there is input and that they're going to have that will help shape that.
I guess when you get to the end of this process, I don't know, is there like a time frame on this, or I get obviously you want some stuff in place when you go into next season, but what do you hope to kind of come out of this, experience with?
So some qualitative, some quantitative. We established in meeting one, our goals are twofold: improve the fan experience, increase attendance. How the fan experience is improved is very subject to whoever it is that is evaluating it. But we do want to walk away with very specific action items from this group. And for example, in this last meeting, we had I think seven that we already came up with that are in the works. And we have a portal on our website where all this information is going to be logged each meeting. Some of these are going to be very small things that are, easy wins that should have been done a long time ago or things that were just oversights. And some of them hopefully are going to be very major. I would also anticipate that there's going to be things that we discuss in this fan council throughout 2025 that potentially could be implemented in 26, 27, 28, and beyond, because they are more large scale in the operation that it takes to get there. But like I said, our hope is to really line up the priorities of the fan council and what are the sore spots. Like, it just as a fan experience chair that I'm in, what's a reason somebody's not coming to our games, and how can we remove those? So I think that's a really big goal of the group, and I feel very confident that the group we've assembled is going to give us the information we need to help line that up.
It's kind of just eliminating the obstacles. And I know you said at the beginning, most people are going to say, and they say it to me last year when I was kind of talking about it, is like, it really comes down to the team at the end of the day. Is there a team in place that people want to come out and see? So it's removing all those obstacles that, kind of when the team is good, having people come out
Yeah.
there.
And Preston, I'll say, like, talk about removing obstacles. I was floored game one, my first year working here in 22, that we had no shuttles. Like, it actually shocked me that it was even possible that we didn't have shuttles from JPJ and Fontaine to get fans here from the free parking lots. Now, I grew up with a tailgate pass in the lower west lot. That was not my experience on game days. Like, we just walk on onto the stadium. Certainly, we had the halftime reentry, go out and grab a biscuit from Hardee's and get back into the game. But if you're somebody who was in that experience walking 25, 30 minutes to get to the game, I mean, I think I literally said in a meeting, why on earth would you ever come back to a game if that was your first time coming to a game at Scott Stadium? And so that is an example that, we circled wagons, we got the correct people in the room. A donor was able to help us pilot that program 2 years ago. Last year, it was absorbed within the game operations. This year, we're working with University P&T to make it even better, potentially including ADA access at all of our different lots, which I think is going to be a huge plus for fans that need accessibility. But that's an example that sometimes changes are slow. They're on the way, but it is shocking sometimes how many barriers have been put in place over the years that we're trying to get rid of.
For you, what do you envision kind of is the perfect, game day experience? Like, what does Scott Stadium look like when, it's what you kind of dream of when you got this job?
I think, well, I'll start with, first of all, that aligning the fan base is critical, and it is harder than ever to do that for any fan base. I'm going to just say that generally, working in other institutions. Over the last 5, 10, 15 years, we as just general people expect everything to be customized to us, right? Like, you have a phone with all the different apps that are very specific to you. You have, your entertainment options, like when you're at home streaming, that are just thousands and thousands of options that you can have. You look at the comfort of different entertainment options like movie theaters and things like that. It's challenging because the only thing that unites UVA fans when they come to one of our sporting events is they want to see us win. And we'll have people that say it is way too loud in the stadium. We'll have people that say, crank it up. We'll have people that say, I think it's ridiculous how you play old music. We'll have people that say, you play way too much new music. And you go on down the line with every single decision that's made. It's challenging because everybody, rightfully so, wants a fan experience that is catered to them. And to circle back to your question, the only thing we can really do is provide touch points that every single type of person that comes to our game feels that there is at least something for them or several things for them. And I said it in my interview, like, whether you're 7 or 77, you should be able to come to Scott Stadium and feel that it's for you. And this experience is something that you want to come root on Virginia to victory. And there are many pieces of that are evergreen, that do affect everybody, but there are also very individual experiences, particularly when it comes to the game presentation, that has to be diversified to kind of fit everybody's different mold. And my hope is that over time we can develop a more consistent identity of what a game at Scott Stadium is. A big piece of that is getting these roadblocks out of the way. But once we clear those, then what is it like to attend a game in Scott Stadium, and how does that directly influence and improve the brand around UVA football and not serve as an impediment?
When you get that first draft of the schedule, kind of looking forward now, is there, do you highlight a game like, all right, this is where we want to go big here or something like that? Or are there games that excite you? Obviously, there's some juicy ones on the schedule for next year.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be the one to say it, Circle Tech, because that's always the one that we need to win, and we need to do the best job possible to create that home field advantage. And As a fan over many years, it's been tough. I'm not gonna lie, it has been tough. But as I said before, we're starting to level the playing field, and I think that the key for us is to A, win the game, and B, capitalize in every single way off of it. I think that we have some plans in place to change the way that's done this year, and hopefully reward Virginia fans for their loyalty to our program. So that's more to come on that later on. But looking at the rest of the schedule, of course, Florida State's a flashy name. Everybody wants to see that. I mean, I love it as a Friday night. You presume a standalone ESPN type game. A big opportunity for us to kind of put ourselves on the map with, here's what our fan experience is. If you're a recruit, Friday night is a little bit tough sometimes, but there's going to be a lot of opportunity for our coaching staff and the recruiters to be able to go out and say, this is what Scott Stadium looks like for these primetime type games. Because I grew up and we had those types of games, and it's been a while since we had them pretty consistently, but we got to take advantage of those opportunities when they come up. And then the other piece, when we talk about circling the schedule, is like, what can we do for some of these games that are maybe traditionally less desirable to make it a more affordable option so that we can get fans in here that are looking for that. And so I've been at work with the ticket office over the last several months in identifying several games that we're going to be able to come up with some very compelling priced games that I think is going to help as we look to really grow our fan base to where we need it to be.
One thing I always hear, because I remember, I think it was Tony Elliott's first season, we had that long stretch of noon games almost every week.
Brutal.
And I know it's brutal. It is brutal, especially when you're talking about tailgating and you're like, all right, I guess I'm making breakfast again this week. What I guess, do you have an ideal time? Because I hear positives and negatives for every time game that you can have.
It's funny. So I'd actually pulled the data for this over the last 20, 25 years, and we experience about a 15% bump in attendance from noon to the 3:30-ish game, and then again from the 3:30-ish to a 7 o'clock game. I think generally, as the season goes on, you want to start more with the night games and kind of loosen up. I don't think I'm ever a fan of a noon game. I mean, it is the reality of it. Preston, when I was at Texas Tech, the Big 12 contract had four games with Fox and then the one with ESPN when we were a 10-team league. And three of those four spots were 11 a.m. games, Central Time. And, I was there during the Mahomes years and it was a lot of fun. However, we were not necessarily winning games. So we had one season where we had five 11 a.m. games and a 2:30 game. And it's tough. I mean, it really is tough for the fans, but the hope is that we can have more of these afternoon games and these evening games. I mean, I think the 3:30 is kind of the sweet spot, especially as you get later in the year. You do have time to tailgate, but it's not so challenging for those who do travel in from Tidewater, Southside, Nova, Southwest VA, et cetera. But yeah, those early season games, I always wanted to be night games, and my hope is that we will be able to deliver that because it's just a little extra juice in the crowd to kind of get the season started.
Going back to last year, that Maryland game, like I know the result wasn't what people wanted, but it like there was good amount of energy going into that game, and Scott Stadium felt a little different that night, just kind of had, and you had ACC Network there, and you had some hype and some talk going into that game. So yeah, I
Yeah, you want to win your way into getting those opportunities. And that is definitely part of the calculus of how those decisions are made. But for me, in our chair, when we can't control the kickoff times, is what do we do to maximize it like that Maryland game and provide that experience that, even though we did lose that game, there were a lot of recruits in that game that were like, wow, Scott Stadium is pretty cool. And like, we got to take advantage of those opportunities when they're afforded to us.
Well, Eric, I think that's pretty much all I wanted to hit on. It seems like y'all've got a lot of work to do over these next how many ever months before we get to football season. I haven't done the math. How many Saturdays away are we now?
About 30 to go.
There you go. You got a lot of stuff to go. But Eric, thanks so much for coming on the Who's On podcast.
Thanks, Preston.
All right, that's going to do it for the Who's On podcast. We will see you all next week. We're going to recap the spring game. We got the ball hawk, Ahmad Hawkins, coming on to talk about spring football. Should be a good one. We'll see you then.
On the field, winning comes from hard work, care, and preparation. I learned that same hard work doesn't stop when we exit the arena. Your care is our commitment and preparation is our promise. We tackle challenges head on and turn dreams into reality. which is why I'm excited to join the team at Alcova Mortgage, where we help you score the perfect home.